A great friend of WBGO and a great friend of jazz. Hollis King joins us. He is a big part of the new production that's going on at the Billy here in Brooklyn, A Walk into Slavery. It's basically the story, Hollis, of your trip to Ghana last year. First of all, it's great to see you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, WBGO and you, Doug, for coming to Brooklyn to cover A Walk into Slavery. It's I have a great love for BGO, and you and Gary in the morning, you always make me laugh. So to all my friends at BGO, I want you to know that I am always with you. Yes, I went to Ghana last year, a place I've always avoided going because of the story and the history. But sometimes you can't put things off anymore. So Ghana was one of those things that you must do to connect with the past, to understand the present and how you navigate the future.
We're here right on the stage that you'll be performing. And people know Hollis as being an award-winning, you know, international designer, photographer, involved with jazz music, the artistic, the creative director, the former VP at Verb Records, also involved with the restoration of the Coltrane House, and all these things are just a part of him. But one thing that's not really comfortable for you is to actually be on stage.
I have always been proud of being in the background, creating ideas, and watch them take life. Being on stage is not something I've done, but I hate to live in regret. So if there's an opportunity to do something new and learn something new, I think I have to be courageous enough to do that. So this is one of those steps.
The executive director of the Billy Holiday Theater here at Restoration Art is Indira Itwaru, and it was her idea after she heard the stories of Hollis King to say, hey, you know, I think you should do this show for people. You weren't so convinced right away, though, were you?
Yes, I begged to differ with her, and I said, no, I think it's all right. I just wrote this for myself. I didn't think I was going to share any of the intimate details of this with others. But sometimes the specific story can be universal to many other people. So there might be some good in sharing the story with others. So I capitulated, and here I am.
2019 marks the 400th year of the first enslaved Africans brought to the Jamestown settlement in America. So very, very timely to have a show like this. Tell us how it's going to look here. We're right on stage. There's going to be music, there's going to be poetry, and there's going to be storytelling.
Dr. Indira Itwaru, who is producing and directing this show, has created this unique world for us to live in. So at the center sits this contained box where I tell the story. On the two sides, on the outsides, there is a gatherer who gathers people and takes them from one world to the other. On the other side, outside of this box, is going to be Mother Africa, who is a singer, who is an all-seeing, all-knowing, omnipotent person that we never quite, it's not one person, it's a representation of the world. And so we go back and forth, even though there are three people, they are integrated and connected in all of the stories. And so I am telling a day-to-day specific personal story. And they are connecting the universal story of our humanity, of our being.
How do you deal with having an emotional response to this trip and still being able to basically perform and to tell the story? Because it's going to bring up so many things in your mind. So how do you deal with that kind of, you know, emotion?
I think, you know, for us of African descent, there's a type of living we do that's a double consciousness. There is a ground we stand on that's not firm. And for me, the trauma of seeing so many young people being killed all the time really shakes me to the core. And this African trip was propelled along by the idea of, what am I looking at today? when will this stop? When would people stop being silent? When do we have a more fair, equal, just world? So just everybody can live. Where do we find peace on earth? You know, and so what does a body laying on the street for 4 hours today have to do with a past like West Africa? Well, it's all connected. It's all connected in terms of the history, in terms of just the struggle to be normal. Nothing more than anybody else, just to be treated normally. It's a struggle every day, and the vigilance that one must have to maintain a certain amount of freedom and humanity is required all the time. The current politics reminds us of that.
What was the most surprising part of your trip? The part that really you weren't expecting?
I think so much of it was unexpected. I think, well, from the time you get off the plane and you go to immigration, I had an incident at immigration. It was this immigration officer who smiled at me. That's the first thing. And he says, "Have you been here before?" I said, "No," smiling back. And he says, "Boom," in my passport, 90 days to start. Welcome home. That almost took my legs off from below me. What is this? I just got off the plane. What is this? And it just, you know, one of the amazing things about history is that in 400 years, the anthropology, the architecture of our physiognomy, our faces, betray the history. So when you go there, people say, they think they know you. They think you are related to the Igbo, or you are an Ashanti, or they, and that's mind-blowing, that we are walking around with this architecture that we are not aware of, that tells the story of 400 years.
You see the world through so many aspects of art, whether it be the physical architecture you're talking about, whether it be the photographs, whether it would be the drawings that you do, whether it would be the music that you're associated. Almost information overload for you, I would imagine, in Ghana.
Well, it makes you richer. It makes you... You see, one of the things that I think Africa does, it makes you big. It gives you permission to be bigger. You know, the people look like you, beautiful homes, beautiful ideas that you haven't thought about. It just makes you bigger. Sense of color, sense of pattern, sense of how anywhere you go in the world, I've noticed, it's that everybody has found a way to do things. It might be different to yours, but if you're open enough, you can learn something. And I think I learned a lot.
We're speaking to the amazing Hollis King here on the stage at the Billie Holiday Theater in Brooklyn, A Walk into Slavery, conceived and directed by Dr. Ndira Atwaru, the executive director of the Billie, and based on the oral history of the award-winning international designer and photographer. Hollis, when you had a chance to interact with people, you've given us a sense of what it's like. Who touched you the most? Was it somebody older, somebody younger? I have a feeling that each person has their own story, but who sticks out to you the most?
You know, I have this habit of being in the world, as a citizen of the world, and when people always see me somewhere in the world, they said, "Have you been there before?" And I'll say no, but it looks like I'm there before, because I've discovered that most human beings wants to take care of their family, wants to be happy and feel safe, wants to eat. And if you start at that level and just also coming in, not high, but low, what is that? How do you eat that? Wow. And you just open up. It's like you're going to school. You know, so many people have touched me, and the way they do things. I remember going to a market, and this guy had two of the most unassuming pieces of tools in his hand, and he was carving these elephants. He had carved from large to small like a family of elephants that he lined up. And for the tusk, he had taken an old toothbrush and carved out angles on the toothbrush and stuck them into the holes he made on the little wood elephants for tusk. And I just thought, it can be so simple yet so beautiful, taking nothing and making. That's the key to making good art, right? Taking nothing and making something out of it. So again, I was learning something, or even seeing options that can be right in front of you that you could pass up. So it has been a wonderful enrichment. I treasure it. But everywhere I go in the world, I always find it just like going to school, you know? So a walk into slavery display, when people come to this, they're going to see just my reaction to the trip, some of the thoughts it triggered, and some of the surprising places that I went that I could not have seen until you've done it. So we have Carl Hancock Rocks, this amazing guy. He paints worlds with words. He has the most amazing voice to do it. And we have a singer that can take the phone book and make it sound so beautiful. So we are going to be working together so you can see all three of us mix to tell one story, one universal story about our humanity. And Dr. Inira Etwaru has lighting and projection magic that she's going to create. We're going to take you into a world that's different, that's going to surprise you, and it's not what you're going to be expecting. It's just going to be a wonderful creative synergy that will take you into a place that hopefully that will make you think.
We're speaking with Hollis King, and you don't have too much time to ponder on this now. This is a real quick run that's going on here at the Billy. It will be from April 30th through May 4th. All right, so you're only allowed, they put you in a room and they say, you can only take one piece of art that you made from this trip, whether it be drawing or whatever. You can only have one thing that you did to take with you forever, and that's all you get. What's it a picture of, or what's the object?
I like asking this question to most people, but I met a man who worked at the University of Ghana. He worked there, but he was also a religious minister. And we were standing in the lobby, and I had my sketchbook, and I said, please don't move. And in 3.5 minutes, I had made a portrait of him. And he was so blown away. So I said, take a picture so you could have it, because I didn't want to tear the sketchbook up. And he ran around the lobby, said, he just did this to me. Look at this. He had so much joy. And he was just such a wonderful human being. That moment was really, really wonderful.
What do you see? So when you're doing a portrait of somebody in a sketch, what's the first thing you start to draw, and what do you notice first?
Ah, so I'm looking at you, Doyle. And the amazing things about drawing people is that they are all the same. You will say, how could that be? So there is a geometry to the face. There's a top of the head and the chin. So halfway between the top of your head and your chin is the beginning of your eyebrows. So once you got that measurement, then you take your finger and you run it to the right with your right hand across to your ear, and you will see that your ears lines up with your eyebrows. Then you're going to take your chin to your eyebrow, and you're going to notice like halfway between your chin and your eyebrow will come your mouth. And then slightly above that is the bottom of your nose. Now, in everybody, there's slight variations on thickness of lip and nose and so on. But all your nose, they always start at the inner edge of the beginning of your eye. Then, usually between your bottom of your nose and your chin, halfway will be your mouth. It varies from person to person. And then you figure out the three sets of muscles that you have on your chin, and that goes back to your ears. As you get older, they become less firm, so that's how we get age. And everybody follows that geometry. So I look at everybody, and while I'm doing the proportions, I see the slight variations. And you don't see it, you see it piece by piece, and when you're done, surprisingly, it looks like the person.
But isn't that also how you see people? You don't see what a lot of people see as far as, you see people being similar, people having this all same desire, and the color of their skin, and the content of their character, as you know, Dr. Martin Luther King would say, or their social status. I have a feeling that Hollis King doesn't see any of that when he looks at people.
So, one of the most amazing things of what it means to be human for me is that we assume we're all humans. But to me, all humanity is a continual growth. And it means to be more kind, more caring, more loving, more human to each other, more considerate of each other. And so when I travel, I always go to old people and talk to them. And it's so amazing how similar they are, how kind some of them are, how much they share with you, whether you're in Italy or you're in Tangier or whatever. You can have the best time. And this whole idea that we are so different, we are not. This is an artificial political thing that people do, people who don't want to share or who keeps things to themselves. But to be a full human being, to enjoy the short time we are on the earth, it requires a certain kind of growth in your humanity. I have a story for you. This is my last story for you. I'm going home one night. I didn't take my car. I'm going to Long Island. It's raining. It's drizzling. But that fine drizzle that just irritates you. You don't need the shelter, but makes you cold. So I took the Long Island Railroad to the last stop. And then I had to take a taxi home. I get into the back of this taxi, and they're waiting for one more passenger. It's a kind of suburban thing where they drop you based on your proximity to the train to your house. So while we're waiting for the next passenger, there's a man sitting in the back seat before me. He could be Irish with long silvery hair. And he looks out the window and he says, "I'm so lucky. The weather held out today for my service." He just says that in the air, and I thought that was strange. So then I said, "What it is you do?" He said, "I'm a funeral director." That sat for a second, and then I said, "As a funeral director, what it is you know about life by dealing with so much death?" And it was like the floodgates opened. It was like this man had it all. And it came out of his mouth. He says, "I've buried all kinds of people." He said, "I've seen all kinds of deaths. I've buried black people, white people, fat, skinny, all kinds, fire, accidents. I've seen it all." He says, "When I go out with my friends and something happens in the restaurant, they say, 'Did you see that?'" He says, "Yeah." "Aren't you annoyed?" He says, "No." He says, "Most of what we worry about works itself out in life." He says, "Life is very, very short. So get on with life." I'm sitting in the back of a taxi trying to go home. And this man had crystallized so much philosophy in the back of a cab. And that's what I say. You can get stuff from anywhere if you're open.
I think that's where you and I really can connect, because I won't let anybody get away with something like, you know, it's going to be okay for my service. I'm definitely asking that next question and finding out what they're doing. I'm just like you as far as that is concerned. Let's go back to Trinidad for a little bit. If your grandmother wasn't around, I don't think Hollis King would be on this stage and probably wouldn't be the amazing success that you are or the outlook that you have on life, right?
Yes, so my grandmother is in the play. She's everywhere with me every day. She gave me everything. When she died, I cried off and on for 5 years. And that's what love looked like.
What's your earliest rememberances of your grandma? What were you doing?
You gotta come to the play, but my grandmother took me to the doctor one day after she'd given me a bath because I had a roasting fever. The doctor said, oh, he just has a fever. She said, doctor, my grandson can't stand up. I was afflicted with polio. I was 3 years old. And when someone holds on to you at that point, you never forget it.
When did she join you? Now you said, you know, you take her everywhere. But when did she really join you in Ghana?
She's always in my head. She's always telling me what to do. She's always helping me with decisions. And she would always used to say that I'll always be with you. And she is. So whenever I have to do something that requires courage, make an important decision, I hear her voice.
You're going to have to see a Walk into Slavery to find out more of the stories about Hollis King and his grandmother and the impact that she has made on his life. Let's talk a little bit about your connection to music. We're going to talk briefly about your latest endeavor with Monty Alexander, but if you could pick one jazz tune to encapsulate your trip, what would that be?
Boy, you know, as this question comes up, I'm seeing all these great album covers. Doc Cheatham with the African Mask, Afrique by Duke Ellington. It's, you know, so many people have looked to Africa for inspiration, you know, and you walk around and you see an orchestra of drums that creates music like you've never heard, or people dance like you've never seen people dance. And it's at the core of all of our music, all of the jazz, all of, you know, Fela and James Brown, you know. God. I don't think I have a specific album. I mean, I can think of Coltrane, Africa Brass, and how much that meant to me. And Manteca by Dizzy Gillespie. That's crazy beautiful. So much. I mean, for me, you know, I could play Clifford Brown with strings anywhere, Charlie Parker with strings anywhere, and I'll be fine. Or I can play Cannonball Adderley with Nancy Wilson, and I'm fine anywhere in the world. You know, I have some good ones, but those are some of my favorites. And of course, Love Supreme by John Coltrane.
We started off this interview by saying that you're kind of uncomfortable performing on stage. You like to be, you know, behind the scenes. But I have to tell you, Hollis, I could listen to you tell stories for days, because just seeing the emotion in your face, and when you talked about your grandmother and when you talked about this trip, it was very special to you. I guess the next question is, are you going to go back at some point?
Yes. I think it's a wonderful well to draw from. I came from a family of educators and stuff who came to the United States, went to school in Wisconsin and different places, and married African men and moved to Africa. And became doctors and stuff. So I've always known about this African presence. And a few years ago, a cousin of mine who is a professor said to me, on my last times I saw her, "Have you been to Africa?" I said, "No." And she yelled at me. He says, "No excuse, go there now." Or it's like Jeffrey Holder saying, "Have you been to Haiti?" And I said, "No." He says, "Absolutely, go there now. It's too much culture, it's too much art for you not to be part of or to learn from."
You've learned from a lot of people, and one of them definitely was Jeffrey Holder. You told me before we started this interview, he would check on you at least once a week on the weekend, and you guys would have
Yeah. So you know, if you're lucky, there will be people that will come into your life and change you. The great designer teacher Milton Glaser was one of those. My grandmother was one of them, and then there was Jeffrey. You know, Jeffrey was overarching, and if he liked you and really liked you, he said, "I will teach you everything I know." And he did. And so I use him as a guiding force when I make decisions as well. So I've had a lot of people that some of them are in the other world, but they still influence my thinking and my ideas of beauty and art and taking nothing and making something out of it. You know, Jeffrey would always say, "Do not be on time. Be ahead of time. If you're on time, you're already too late. Do not be in fashion. If you're in fashion, it's already too late," you know. And he would just drop things. You know, these people crystallize a lot of life into these small pieces that you could digest. So, yeah, I have been blessed and fortunate and grateful.
The richness of Hollis King on display in A Walk into Slavery that's running here at the Billie Holiday Theater in Brooklyn. And that is from April 30th through May 4th. You also have this collaboration that you're working with Monty Alexander on. Tell us about that.
Oh, I don't know if I should say much about that because it's not out yet, but all I can say, I heard some of this tribute to Monk that he's doing that will blow your mind. So it's a work in progress. Stay tuned for the release. And the people on this record is just a who's who of music, crossing genres and just really innovating, just going their own way and finding beauty.
You're an emotional guy like I am, and I would imagine that the tears flow more often in you and I than the average person. So as we look out into the audience, there's nobody here right now as we do this interview, but other than, you know, the people that would normally show up to see you, who would a face that you would capture in the audience and go, "Oh, I can't believe he or she is here tonight," and you're just overcome with emotion? Who would that be?
I don't get to do that. When I'm telling the story, if I am in the group doing the thing with everybody else, it's about the story. Maybe I'd lock eyes with somebody to connect with a word, with a line, but I am just in the space. I want to be servant to the words and to the other people on the stage, yeah.
All right, it's over though. All right, and everyone's clapping for you, and now you look out, the lights come up, and now you see who would be out there that would mean something to you. You're not gonna get away with that easy.
I think friends, you know, people who show up for you. And usually the people who show up for you are the ones who show up in life. And they say, of course, there they are, and you're so grateful. You're so humble that they think of you that much to show up. But I am going to try not to embarrass any one of my friends and be also a good partner with Indira, Carl Hancock Rocks, and Marcel Davies, that we could tell a story that's together, that's impactful, that's meaningful, so people could walk away and be thinking for themselves.
You've received so much critical acclaim. You've won so many awards, the Grammy Awards and all. I have a feeling that doesn't mean so much to you. But is there some sort of honor that bestowed upon you that meant more than something else?
To my fault, I don't look at awards. I said, oh, that's nice, I'm honored, but then I put them away. And then I look at what's next. I mean, you know, I think what those honors do is they confirm your insanity. They confirm that someone can stand on their own and make decisions, and it's good decisions. But that it's a representation that you are plotting your way, finding your way, and standing up for what you think is right and what you believe in. But that's it. It's just like a marker to me. But I don't look at them. I put them, you know, I don't look at any of that. Sometimes I even forget, oh, I did that or I got that. It's always about, it seems like it's an accumulation of the past to where I am now and how I could better do what I have to do. Yeah, but not really, I don't.
Hollis King's A Walk Into Slavery, conceived and directed by Dr. Indira Twaru, the executive director of the Billie Holiday Theater. Also joining us will be Carl Hancock Rux, the award-winning poet, playwright, novelist, and essayist, as well as recording artist. He'll be a big part of this show as well. There also will be plenty of singing and music. What a thrill it is to sit down with Hollis King. Great to see you again. And the smile that you have, that is enough. But, you know, I could go on and talk to you, I think, probably for many, many days. But you have to work, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks for joining us on the WBGO Journal.
Thank you so much, WBGO, and you, Doug, and Gary, and Shayla, and everybody at WBGO. I love you all madly. And I'm just thrilled. Come see A Walk Into Slavery. We have also matinees and students, and there will be some talkbacks where we can get a conversation going. So if you could come from New Jersey or the environs, please come. There are matinees and students and special discounts. We look forward for you coming to the short run. Thank you.
Joined by Carl Hancock Rux, the award-winning poet, playwright, novelist, essayist, recording artist. What haven't you done?
I don't know. Yeah, lots of things. There's lots of things I haven't done. Sports. Ask me anything in sports. Really, that's not my world.
We'll stay away from the sports, I promise. A Walk Into Slavery. When did you first become a part of this collaboration? How did that happen?
Well, I guess it was about a year ago, when Dr. Indira Twaru told me that she wanted to do this project, and that that this year was going to be this sort of milestone year, you know, regarding Africans in America, and she asked would I be involved in it. But also prior to that, we'd been talking about, prior to a year ago and this particular project, Dr. Twaru and I had been talking about creating works for the Billie Holiday Theater that would be more experimental than they normally did. You know, either the theater itself tends to do, I would say, you know, I don't really want to, I guess I would say they tend to do plays that are more traditional, and this project is one of the first projects that I've been involved with them in that is more conceptual in form and creation.
We're here on the set. Tell us, we had Hollis tell us a little bit how it's set up, but tell us your role here and just kind of the presentation that you have to do in A Walk Into Slavery.
Well, there are three characters. One is performed by Marcel Davies Lashley, who is a singer and actress. She plays Africa. I play The Gatherer, which is an interesting character. He's endowed with historical memory, even beyond, I guess, the memory that has been recorded, as well as the memory of, you know, as well as colonial memory, transatlantic memory. When he speaks, the character that I play, it's quite poetic. And he sees into the future, he sees into the past, he understands the present. And so all of that I wrote. And then there's Hollis King, who's playing himself and really having a retelling of his visit to Ghana and to the Elmina Castle in Ghana, which was built by the Portuguese in the 15th century, and where a large amount of Ghanaians were first incarcerated and then shipped off and became part of chattel slavery.
When I say Africa, what's the first thing that pops into your mind?
Wow. So many things pop into my mind when you say Africa. I think of it as the genesis of human existence, or at least the place of the genesis of human existence, as far as we know right now, scientifically. I mean, the oldest living human remains that we've ever found were in Africa. That said, it is also a created place. Africa is a word that we use right now to, as we do with other countries, you know, to describe sort of a body of land or mass or continent. But I think that its locale is very interesting in that it predates all of our preconceived notions of, or even the language that we have for the places that we describe as Africa or America or Asia or Europe. You know, it's a central part of the earth, a very important part of the earth. It's ancient, and its history is ancient, and the other thing I guess that pops into mind is how unrecorded a lot of its information is. That is always fascinating to me. I think we will always find ourselves discovering new things about the history of Africa. But there will be many things that we will not ever know because it is so ancient, because it's been here for so long, and because, and it predates our concepts of sort of recording history, historical records.
You mentioned the timeliness of this. 2019 marks the 400th year of the first enslaved Africans brought to the Jamestown settlement in America. There's always this ongoing debate. Does talk of slavery fuel more anger? Is it something that we have to touch upon? Is it something we need to learn more about? Where do you stand on that?
I think we owe it to ourselves to learn as much as we can about the history of slavery in America, because it is America. It is part of how America was created, even prior to America being America. It is a history that belongs not just to African Americans or to black people, but to all the people who live here, the indigenous, people who were here prior to colonization. It's a history that belongs to the colonizers as well as the descendants of all colonizers. It is a history that belongs to all immigrants. It is a history that belongs to all descendants of the enslaved Africans as well as immigrants of African descent. Anyone who lives in this country needs to understand it. And anyone who lives in any country where slavery actually existed, because America is not the only country where there was slavery. And as long as we understand it and as long as we continue to talk about it and make it part of our constant our constant daily discussion, we will hopefully do our best to make sure that it never happens again, and that it never happens again in certain iterations. Because I think that it's very easy to sort of, say slavery was one thing, and then not actually give credence to other ways in which we enslave people, other ways in which we incarcerate people, other ways in which we make people second-class citizens, other ways in which we create forced labor, other ways in which we take human existence for granted. So there are so many things. It's an atrocity. It's an atrocity that lasted longer than it ever should have and never should have existed in the first place, but it did exist, and we acknowledge that. And so in order for us to move forward as a people, and when I say a people, I mean all over the world, we need to acknowledge our atrocities and our mistakes. And slavery is a huge part of being able to acknowledge that.
We're speaking with Carl Hancock Rux, part of A Walk into Slavery, running through April 30th through May 4th, right here at the Billie Holiday Theater in Brooklyn. We're on stage right now with Carl. As we heard Hollis talk about his wonderful relationship with his grandmother, and he talks about it in this show, who does Carl think about in that way?
Who do I think about in terms of how Hollis thinks about his grandmother?
Yeah, that unbelievable relationship that they had, and that he credits her for so much of who he is. Who's behind Carl in that way?
There are many people behind Carl, but my life is our lives are very different. I was adopted. I was adopted when I was 15 years old, which is why I have two last names. People always wonder why my name is Carl Hancock Rux. Well, the Rux is because I was adopted. And when I was 15, I didn't want to give up being Carl Hancock, because that's what I knew. So I did legally take the Rux name. My adoptive parents certainly were saving graces in my life. They were older people. It was an older couple who'd never had children of their own. James Henry Rux and Arsula Rux. He was born in 1915 in New York City, in Harlem. She was born in 1923 in Harlem. I was raised by this couple, these people who were generations older than I was, which was a gift I think that the universe gave me in so many ways. They're both gone now, but I could never credit them enough for all of the things that they talked to me about. And that they shared with me about their lives and about the worlds that they lived in. I don't think that many people who are my age get the advantage or have the advantage of having those kinds of relationships, or at least I should say, relationships as close as I was able to have with them, because it was a parental relationship, as opposed to, let's say, a removed grandparent or a removed great grandparent. He was a World War II veteran. She was a dancer in Harlem. They had a very certain perspective. He had no more than a fifth grade education. She was very smart, very literate. I certainly have to credit Arsula Cottrell Rux with, my love for literature and my love for the arts, which is huge. I think that there's something really important about the fact that they were a couple. Which is not to say that he was not a smart man. He was a very smart man, but he only had a fifth grade education. And as a lot of people did who were born when he was born, where you had to take care of your own family and you had to survive, during the Depression and beyond, or go off to war. It's not like it is today, where I guess school was as mandatory in certain ways. And especially being an African-American male, the onus was on him to take care of his younger brothers and sisters. even though he didn't have the opportunity to continue his education, there's another kind of education that we all can benefit from, which is just the education of living, the education of seeing, the education of being, the education of meeting other people, and of traveling. He's a Bronze Star recipient in World War II, but of course that came with its own darkness because he was an African American in World War II who, you know, had to fight for his country while being a second-class citizen, you know, in the country that he was fighting for. That shaded, coded, and in many ways informed how I think he understood race, how he understood the world, which is not to say that he didn't like white people or that he didn't like people of other colors, but it certainly informed how he saw himself, and it made him keenly aware that his blackness was never going away, and that regardless of the strides that had been made in his lifetime, because he lived to be 83, it made him in some ways keenly aware that at any point everything could change on a dime. And with something I think he reiterated to me constantly, you know, said to me, you know, always, that, you know, never take your freedom for granted, never take the opportunities that you have in life for granted. Anything could happen at any given moment. You are your freedom. Your intellect is your freedom. Your knowledge is your freedom. And regardless of what administration you see yourself living in, whatever political administration you see yourself living in, you will always have to fight for what you want and what you believe in this world. And that's, I credit those two people.
What a beautiful couple you just described there. Okay. We're speaking with Carl Hancock Rux, one of the stars of A Walk Into Slavery, running at the Billy from April 30th through May 4th. As people leave this wonderful facility here at Restoration Art, what do you want them to be talking about after seeing this show?
One of the things I'd like them to talk about, which I think isn't talked enough about, is the psychosocial effects that slavery has had on all of us. When I say all of us, again, I'm speaking about an inclusive society, black, white, yellow, blue, everybody who's here. Especially, however, on people of African descent. I would like them to think about what it means to live in a country where, you know, where chattel slavery was real, and where human ownership was real and not so distant. It's not 1,000 years ago. It's not a millennia. You know, we so-called emancipation only just happened in the 19th century. And I'm really happy to have been a part of, I should also say recently, I did some work with Henry Louis Gates on a PBS documentary about migration in this country and post-Civil War. And he makes this wonderful, wonderful point about, you know, sort of emancipation, but then how, well, rather I should say, he questions whether or not there was an emancipation, because there was a Jim Crow era, you know. There were so many things that happened that didn't really allow for the freedoms that were promised, the people who were supposed to have been freed. So I'd like people to think about that word, freedom. Are you free? Are we free? Are we free now? Are we free by proclamation? If so, by whom? By when? How do you demand your freedom? And then also to think about one's personal freedom and to think about what you have to constantly demand of yourself, your community, your state, your country, your world, in order to redefine the word freedom for yourself.
You do know that your cadence, that your feelings, very poetic, just when you're just talking to me, which lends me to think, is a poet born, or is, do you learn how to be a poet, or is it already inside you?
That's a great question. I think poets, I think you can learn about poetry. You can probably learn how to write poetry, but I don't think that's what a poet is. I think that, and I think there are many kinds of poets, and I talk about that a lot. Even when I'm talking to my students, I mean, I think about like the African-American preacher. I used to teach a class about, for instance, I did a radio show during Black History Month, February, for WNYC, and it was about, sorry for the other station, should I say, and it was about the preacher's cadence. And I talked a lot about Martin Luther King and how he had this sing-song speech, but what a great poet. You know, we don't necessarily think of or talk about him as a poet, but he was an absolute poet. I mean, the speeches were brilliant poetry, and at the same time, they were very clear and very succinct. And I think there are many different kinds of poets. So I guess I believe that a poet is born, to answer your question.
You know, you're involved in so many, much like Hollis, in so many different parts of the arts, you know, from writing to recording artist, poet, playwright, novelist, essayist. You're also blessed with this unbelievable voice, which I would imagine when you speak before your students day one, their eyebrows come up and go, whoa, we're going to listen to this guy and it's going to be fun.
I don't know. It's a, you know, I don't know who my father, my actual, but my biological father was. I have no idea. I will assume that I inherited my voice from him. Most people who listen to my voice without seeing me, let's say if I'm talking on the phone or even talking on the radio, assume that I'm 6'5" and, you know, this imposing figure, and I'm not. So I'm kind of this average-sized guy with a big, deep voice, and it's a sort of a funny thing. And as a child, it was always it was a bit of a challenge in a way too, because there were, you know, people who made fun of the voice. And then, as I began to embrace it and just sort of acknowledge, this is my voice, this is who I am, this is, so, you know, go ahead and make the jokes. It is what it is. People did become, you know, people were able to either respect it and or reject it, you know, for whatever reason. Sometimes articulation and sometimes big imposing voices are threatening to people as well as, you know, you can't always assume that everybody loves, you know, the sound of your voice. Everybody doesn't love the sound of your voice, no matter what.
I love the sound of your voice, I'll tell you that. We're speaking with Carl Hancock Rux. You know, when you're going through this show, and I know it's only going to really have a week run here at the Billy, but have other ideas and other projects been starting to brew inside you to say, I'm going to take some of this and I'm going to do this now?
Oh, absolutely. Even prior to working on this project, I was having a discussion with Dr. Antuaro about another project. I'm a big fan of archival newspapers. I'm a big fan of history. I'm a big fan of unearthing marginalized histories. And I think that and the stories that we find. And so I've got file cabinets and file cabinets and file cabinets of full of, you know, some great stories that are absolutely based in fact. And one of the things I was talking to her about was, at one point, was about an African-American gospel singer who was was part of the early years of gospel recording artists, I would say, like during the 1940s, 1950s. I don't want to give too much away, but I just want to say that person was also when that gospel recording artist died, it was discovered that he was born anatomically female, so he had lived his life transgender, and I found that absolutely fascinating. It's one of the first projects that I talked to Dr. Ntwaru about, because I believe that it, creating possibly a work around this mid 20th century transgender gospel recording artist could make us think a little bit about what we understand about sexuality and gender today, and what we also think about God and who has a right to God.
You may have just answered my next question, but maybe not. And that would be, since you're such a lover of history, I have to ask you a question that I ask a lot of people, and that is, take me back in time. What time period would you like to be? Who would you like to sit down and spend 5 minutes with?
Wow, that's a great question, which I've answered for myself many different times, and I can't pick one, but do you want me to just pick one? Or
you can give me a few.
I can give you a few, okay. So I'm very clear that I need to visit, if I could be a time traveler, I need to visit the 1920s. I need to be around during the Harlem Renaissance, because I definitely want to sit and talk with, you know, people like Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes, and not just, also even some of the, you know, the abstract artists of the, you know, visual artists of the 1920s, black and or white, and American and or European. So I would somewhere in the 1920s, I would be living in Harlem, but I'd also be traveling to Paris, and I'd be traveling to, you know, England and Europe and all over the world as much as I could to just sort of talk to people, because I find that period fascinating. One of the things that makes me really attracted to that moment, whether it was about literature or poetry or visual art or music, was that it's sort of post-World War I, and there's this incredible social liberty that seems to emerge just before we enter into World War II, which shuts everything down again. So, you know, this pre-code era, you know, of expression, right? So, and when I say pre-code, you know, it's a term that we use for film, you know, the idea of pre-code, before people decided to, you know, shut down and decide what was ethical or moral or what we were able to say or not say. So I'm really attracted to that era. But I'm also attracted to the 1950s. I'm attracted to the Beat generation. I'm attracted to the 1940s, I should say, Billie Holiday. I'm attracted, you know, definitely because of my parents, and they were huge jazz fans and knew some of these people personally. And I can never get them out of my mind, and I can never get those discussions and descriptions that they had for some of the people who were their neighbors, like, you know, Billie Holiday or Miles Davis or whomever. And my parents are gone now, but I would almost love to have been around in Harlem at that time to have been able to go to some jazz clubs and experience the emergence of this form and to understand what it really meant socially and politically. I'm also really interested in the late 60s or mid to late 60s and the rock and roll era. And, you know, again, when people were kind of, you know, dealing with, a new kind of music, which was called rock and roll. And then, but also at a time of war, like during the Vietnam War, you know, I would not like to go to war, but I would like to have been an adult at a time of war so I could have protested. Sure.
We're about to wrap up here. Is there a jazz tune that years from now, the Carl Hancock Rucks show, and people are learning about you, is there a jazz tune that sums you up, the kind of person you are, the feeling about you, who you are? Is there a tune that pops into your mind?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's called Don't Go to Strangers. Yeah. There was a jazz singer named Etta Jones. As my mother would say, never confuse Etta Jones with Etta James, two different singers. And Etta Jones had this song my mother used to play constantly called Don't Go to Strangers. And I think that the words were, build your dreams on the stars above, but when you need someone to love, don't go to strangers, come home to me. And that has a real significance to me.
Carl Hancock Rucks, part of A Walk into Slavery, running through May 4th at the Billie Holiday Theater here in Brooklyn. Pleasure meeting you, and continued success.
Absolutely. Good to meet you as well.
stars above. But when you need someone true to love, don't go to strangers, darling. Come on to me. Play with fire till your fingers burn. And when there's no place for you to turn, don't go to strangers, darling. Come on to me.